taxation number 209 84 Realty.
Phillips Realto.
We were very cross that we had to be the burial party at Admiral Darlan's funeral, because he was a traitor, really, to the French and, of course, to us. But it was a political move, and I think Churchill thought that it might be a gesture to people who were wavering between support to the Free French and to the De Gaulle boys. So that was our stay in Algiers, we then were told that the Germans were reinforcing fairly heavily up in Tunisia, and they sent our 3rd Battalion. I think in some ways it ought to have been our 1st Battalion of the 1st Guards Brigade, because it was a very, very fine battalion, the 2nd Battalion of the Hampshire Regiment. There was the 3rd Battalion Grenadiers, 2nd Battalion Coldstream, and 2nd Battalion Hampshires.
Which platoon and company were you in?
I was in number 8 platoon, number 1 company of the 2nd Battalion Coldstream.
And what was your rank and duties?
2nd Lieutenant. And just an ordinary, humble platoon commander, one of 3 in number 1 company, commanded by a great man, Captain Paddy Chichester. So that was the beginning, really, of fairly exciting things. The 2nd Hampshires were sent for to go ahead of us, way ahead, like 5 days or 6 days ahead of us, up to Tunisia, because the Germans were reinforcing the hills overlooking the Medjez el Bab Valley and Tunis. And obviously they didn't want us to get into that valley. But the 2nd Hampshires were sent up to a village called Tuboba and the hill above it, where they had the most terrible battle. They fought like Trojans. There was certainly one VC, Patra Patra. And they were very, very brave men and very good soldiers. And they were nearly wiped out. I believe I'm right in saying that only one fighting officer and the padre and the doctor got out with something like 150 men, out of, I suppose, 900 full-strength battalion. But their fight was a very, very brave one, and they had appalling casualties. So then we and the Grenadiers were then sent up, because now the 1st Guards Brigade, which we were in, was one battalion short, virtually. I mean, you couldn't send the Hampshires in again for quite a long time. In fact, they were never sent in again in the 1st Guards Brigade, and were replaced by the 3rd Battalion Welsh Guards, who came up much later. So we were really pretty well a 2-battalion brigade. And we went up to positions behind Medjez el Bab, which was really the start of the Medjez plain to Tunis. And nothing very much happened the first few days. We all did patrols, tapped the German positions. The Germans had very heavily reinforced their troops round the hill we call Longstop Hill, which is now one of our battle honours, the Coldstream battle honours. And we took our turns going out into no man's land, doing reconnaissance and fighting patrols, and they did the same. It was a sort of let's see who each other are situation. We mined our front, and they mined their front. Some of the farms were booby-trapped. And then eventually it was decided that we were to attack Longstop Hill. And we went up on, I think, the 22nd of December. These can, of course, be checked, these dates. to a farm called Chassart de Fart. The Guardsmen called it Chassart de Fart, but it was spelt that way, I believe. And we laid up there for a night. The Germans, I don't think, saw us getting there. It was right in no man's land. And then the battalion moved up under cover of darkness. Three of us officers were dressed as Arabs to do a reconnaissance of the hill. And it was very difficult from that side of the hill to know that there was another hill almost the same height as Longstop. And that was the trouble a little later on. Anyway, the rest of number one company came up, and number four company, number one company commanded by Paddy Chichester, number four by Charles Harford, H-A-R-F-O-R-D. And they moved to the foot of Longstop, and we passed through them. And number one company attacked Longstop. I think it was just before 9 o'clock at night. It was dark and pouring with rain. The rain did then stop, and we got up very nearly to the top of the hill when we came under heavy machine gun fire and mortar fire. Immediately, Paddy Chichester ordered us in, my platoon, number 8 platoon. I had a marvellous platoon sergeant, Sergeant Dalton, and I think number 7 platoon gave covering fire to us as we went in. And the Germans didn't quite like the look of us. The only mistake I think we made was we threw one or two hand grenades uphill, and they were inclined to bounce back a bit, but none of us were hurt. And we attacked their trenches, which were slit trenches, not very deep because it's impossible to dig in the very rocky ground. And the Germans scarpered, but we managed to nab a couple of prisoners. And we obviously shot about four of them. Their bodies are lying there. And so we took Longstop Hill, really, with very little trouble. And our orders were to hand over to a combat team, a battalion of the American Army, at about 3 a.m., I think it was. My memory is not too bright on the actual timing. The Germans shelled us and mortared us and machine gunned us pretty well most of the night. But we took good cover and returned the fire. And it was then we began to realize that there was another feature about the same height as Longstop, away to our left, and some of the fire was coming from there. The reason why we realized this is because the mortar bombs seemed to be coming down on us from above, rather high above, which indeed they were. And a few guardsmen were wounded, and then quite suddenly the attack, the machine gun fire grew worse, and our company commander, Paddy Chichester, was wounded with a bullet through the jugular vein. And Company Sergeant Major Callaghan, a very brave and a very, very fine man in every sense of the word, came up, crawled up to where my platoon was, and said, "You better crawl back, sir." He said, "But the company commander is seriously wounded." So back we crawled. It was very sort of nasty. They were raking the ground a bit with machine gun fire, but the worst was the mortars. And as we crawled, I was blown over, fortunately met by a blast from a mortar. And so I had about 10 minutes to get myself moving again, and we crawled to where Paddy had been wounded, and he was obviously in a very bad position. And almost to my horror, he just managed to croak out, "It's over to you now, Mark." Well, in those days, platoon commanders didn't have any training, really, as company commanders. We knew how to command our platoons, and I think we did that pretty effectively. but we never really had any experience of commanding a company. So from commanding 32 men, we went up to 118, or whatever the figure of the company was. And he croaked at this, and I think they were almost his last words. And he gave a little grin and went into a deep unconsciousness. So I thought, hell's bells, how am I going to manage this? Anyway, in those days, the sergeant majors were really the gems of the Guards battalions, right from the RSM, who we all, even when we were officers, were rather frightened of, who really kept the discipline at a very high standard. And so Sergeant Major Callaghan was an astonishingly good man. And so I moved to what was then company headquarters. We got Paddy back on the stretcher. They carried him 2¼ miles, and sadly he died 2 days later. His brother Desmond was in the battalion, another very fine officer, won a very good military cross. It was, it really, I suppose, was a success that night. And then quite suddenly the sergeant major crawled up to me and he said, "There's a hell of a bloody noise, sir. What's that going on?" Well, I think this has been, it's a little naughty of me to tell you this, because later they fought very well, but it was in fact the American combat team arriving with mess tins rattling, they're smoking cigars, and God knows, it was, we thought, a bit of a rabble. So I went up to the commanding officer, who was the equivalent, I'm not quite sure what his rank was, he was the equivalent of Lieutenant Colonel in the British Army, and he was a fairly jolly man. He said, "Ah, this is the biggest thing since Ben-Hur. This is good, this is good. We're going to kill those bastards." So I said, "Well, they're pretty good, actually, sir. I think you've got to be careful a bit." And by that time, Sergeant Major Callaghan couldn't stand all the cigar smoking. He roared, "Put those bloody cigars out!" And he said, "Stop rattling all that kit." And I was very grateful to Sergeant Major Callaghan, because all the cigars were immediately put out. And I then handed over the positions, which you couldn't dig in. It was far too tough, the rocks formation. And it was very difficult to be able to find enough cover. I'd had my own platoon, number 8 platoon, on the forward slope. And they were brave men, because they were ready. They were firing very accurately at the Germans, and we can only really tell by their muzzle flashes, and roughly where the mortars were being fired from. And later on, a couple of days later, there were any amount of bodies. So we must have done a fairly accurate shoot from that position. Excuse me. And then I said to the colonel, I think, "Well, by time now we go back, we're following the plan, sir. Are you satisfied? Are you happy about the positions?" And he said, "Well, it's all right as long as it doesn't rain." He said, "You guys are lucky." He said, you don't feel the cold like we do." So I couldn't quite think why he said that. But I then heard later, even from the lips of General Eisenhower, who said, "The thing is that we had central heating a long time before you had it in England." And he said, "You're used to the cold and being cold most of the winter." And I think that was probably a fairly true remark. Back we go to the battalion, who had gone back about 5 miles to what I think later became known as Grenadier Hill, which was above Medjez. The bridge was still over the River Majerda. And we formed up, and on Christmas Eve we were told that the stores were coming up from Biestrong, we were going to have, the whole battalion was going to have a Christmas dinner out in the open. So, but that never happened, because Christmas Eve we were informed that the Americans had lost the tops of Longstop Hill. So back we had to march. And this time, same procedure, number 4, we went through number 4 company and attacked this heavily reinforced Longstop Hill. I've written about it for various publications, and I've read about it in some detail in my autobiography, but it was a hellish night. It poured with rain, and the Germans were extremely accurate. But somehow we managed to get back pretty well to our same positions of 2 days before. I have to say here, in fairness to the Americans, their mortar team was simply brilliant and incredibly brave. I think only about three men got out of the battle at the end of the night. And they were very good in covering us in. And indeed, so was our dear old Royal Artillery with their 25-pounders. They were very accurate, and they were firing no friendly casualties, as they used to call it, and called it later. We went about 150 yards behind their barrage, up to the top of the hill. But then the Germans really came back with all their force. And it was a swinging battle for most of the night. I can't remember exactly how many men we lost, but we lost at least three quarters of our officers. And there was a hell of a lot of bravery that night. I had by that time handed over the company to Captain Philip Kindersley, the father of the good amateur steeplechase rider, Gary Kindersley. And I don't honestly remember the time, but the moon was every now and again coming through the clouds, and every time it did, the machine gun fire got hotter from the Germans. There's no doubt about it, they were a very, very good battalion and very accurate. And then we could hear behind the hill the Tiger tanks being warmed up, so we began to expect tanks coming up the lower parts, the lower strips of Longstop. But still we fought on. There was an enormous bravery. Those guardsmen, they took it in a way which I never really expected. In fact, one didn't know what one was going to meet with in a battle. We were all pretty green. Although some of the officers had fought in France and come back through Dunkirk. There are not many of them. But quite frankly, nearly every man, I reckon, ought to have won the military medal, and most of the officers the military cross. And again, one had to crawl, but one did make the odd dash to one's own positions. And one of the odd dashes, whether I was on the skyline or not, I don't know, but I realized I'd been hit. And I couldn't walk. I just dropped like a bit of lead to the ground and managed to crawl back to where our position was. Philip Kindersley, he crawled over. Anybody who stood up and walked across was obviously going to be shot. So it was our elbows got a bit sore and we pushed with our feet. One or two counterattacks were made. And Colonel Bunty Stuart Brown, another very, very brave man, who came right up to the forefront. Some people say he ought to have stayed back, rather like Colonel Jones in the Falkland battle. But they, I think, were the same sort of meat. And they were a tremendous inspiration. Certainly, Bunty Stuart Brown, he rallied us all. And we were being mown down virtually. It was becoming a bloodbath. And then he was wounded. And then Phil Kindersley was wounded. And then the Germans began coming up. They passed within a few feet, really, of where I was lying in a pool of blood. And if they had looked at me, I suppose they thought I was dead. And I kept very still. And Phil Kindersley didn't. He moved. He gave for a moment, so they nabbed him and took him prisoner. But it was a nasty moment. But we still stood our ground. the Germans swung round too far to the right flank, and therefore we were able to fight on for a bit longer. Roddy Hill came up to command the battalion, and he was equally as brave as Bunty Stuart Brown. And they said they'd try and get me down on a stretcher. Well, there were no stretcher bearers left. They'd all been used up. And eventually, Johnny Baxendale, who was the signal officer, he came up with a message because the hill was very bad for communication by wireless, and he came to take messages and was a very brave man. And he more or less dragged, pulled, and carried me down the hill. And I was put onto a Bren gun carrier at the bottom of the hill, driven, funny enough, by a cousin of mine, Bobby Phillips, who lost his thumb that night, wounded. And they got me back to Chasseur de Fart, where Elston Gray Turner, later to be the secretary of the BMA, operated on me in a ditch.
What were your wounds?
Well, they made one or two of my brother officers laugh. I lost a left testicle, and I all down the groin and the stomach. And he operated on me more or less in the dark. He was absolutely tired out when I was carried in to the ditch to be operated on. He wished me a happy Christmas, because we'd forgotten by that time it was Christmas Day, 1942. And so it was quite a Christmas. And he did a brilliant operation, which other surgeons who have operated on me since have all admired intensely. There was very little anesthetic left. The last man to have it was a black American Army truck driver. So I was then put on in the ditch, and Elston Gray Turner said, "One thing I have got," he said, "a bit of whiskey." He's a great man, marvelous sense of humor, no Wickhamist. And so he said, "I'm going to give you about half of this." And he said, "I think I'll probably have the last quarter." Anyway, he did the spectacular operation. And I was then, I can't really remember much about it. And an ambulance, the Germans fired on two or three of the ambulances. And there was a marvellous effort by the Padre, Father George Forbes, later to be a monk at Ampleforth, and Elston Gray Turner, who's not supposed to fire guns and things, is a medical officer, and they both won the Military Cross. And they kept the Germans away as long as they could from Chasseur. And we managed to get away in the ambulances, some of which had bullet holes through. And I can't remember much about the trip in the ambulance, except coming to on one occasion, I thought I was having a bad dream with a German officer standing on in the ambulance looking down on me and saying, "Is there anything I can do to help?" And I think he was the officer commanding the machine gun section who probably wounded most of our chaps, and certainly the mortars wounded me. And so it was rather odd. I only found this out later, but it was rather odd looking up at this German officer who spoke very good English. And I managed, I think, to say, "You speak English well." And he was at Oxford. He had been at Oxford. And he was very helpful, because I was feeling in great pain. I was feeling very ill. And actually, he was very helpful and obviously a very caring person.
Helpful in what way?
Well, he sort of was dabbing one's forehead with cold rags and things, having probably just shot one a few hours before. But that was war. And then I don't really remember a great deal of the next few days. I was very ill. I do remember that Arthur Fortescue, who later became Brigadier Arthur Fortescue, with three military crosses, a very gentle man, as it happened, and a very clever man, also a Wickhamist. And I remember he was the next door bed, and although he has his back machine gunned, and was very bad. He used to come over and give me a helping hand, again sort of getting the sweat off my forehead. And he became one of my greatest friends and still is. And we were sent back in cattle trucks, stretchers hung on them, to Algiers, where we got a marvellous reception from most of the civilian population. Red Cross, women coming to help. And we were then put in, say, on stretchers into ambulances and went to what was the university, which had been turned into, I think, the 97th or 95th Field Hospital, where we very well looked after. The QA nurses came along. They were absolutely brilliant, marvellous. Incredibly long working hours. They really were Florence Nightingales, and I think they saved many of our lives. And that was it. I think I was there in hospital for about 3 or 4 weeks. And that was the end of the hospital period.
Were you able to return to the battalion?
Well, it's an extraordinary thing, I think, being a Guards officer. I'm sure in hundreds and hundreds of other British regiments it's the same, particularly where it's got a family spirit, like the Sherwood Foresters, for instance, and indeed the Rifle Brigade, the 60th, and many other regiments. And it's like a family, and you didn't really want to be away for too long. And so I determined to get back. I acted as training officer to a camp about 10 miles from Algiers, where all the reinforcements had to go through before they went up to the front. And that was quite jolly, a lot of friends there. And so we tried to teach them some of the mistakes we might have made ourselves in the battle, and give them a few hints. And then eventually I tried like mad to get back to the battalion, who by that time was back, funny enough, near Medjez el-Bab, had been reinforced, of course. And Peter Crowder, later to become Judge Peter Crowder, he'd been ill, and so we decided, not exactly to steal a platoon truck from the army, but we more or less pinched it, and we drove up to the front again. It took us 2 days, and it was quite a funny story in itself, the trip up there, which I won't bore you with now, because it's important to get back to the battle. And I returned to the 2nd Battalion, where Roddy Hill was commanding. Bunty is still in hospital. In fact, I'd left him. There were 9 officers of us in the same ward in Algiers from the battalion. And Bunty was really very badly wounded through the bottom. Not that he ever turned his back to the enemy. He's a very, very brave man. And so Roddy Hill was there. He gave us a good welcome. And I was then put into Number 2 Company, under the command of later Colonel Bob Windsor Clive, who commanded the regiment. And this was tough, because I tried to hide things, but in fact I was still on a stick and was pretty lame. And I've always been a fairly good bluffer. If you're dyslexic, you have to bluff your way through a lot of things. Somehow I managed to get permission to stay on in the battalion. Bob Windsor Clive quite rightly said, "You're not fit enough for a rifle company." And so I went. Roddy Hill gave me a bit of a rocket for coming back perhaps a bit too soon. Anyway, he said, "I'll tell you what we'll do." He said, "You can muck around battalion headquarters as a sort of spare. And then I'm going to get you on a course at a place called Souk Arras, which is a Royal Engineer course on mine warfare." So I said, well, I don't know if I'd be much good at that, because I'm very bad at working out figures and things. But that's very kind of you, anything to stay in the battalion. And so he said, well, just hang around as a sort of spare. And I helped the adjutant, Captain Dick Chaplin, in his headquarters for a few more weeks. We were acting, and we were called the plumbers, because wherever...